From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Today we'll talk about changes to Michigan's no-fault auto insurance law and what it will mean for those who have been in a catastrophic accident.
Nursing homes, and that cost will either be borne by, maybe by their car insurance company, but more than likely they're going to end up on Medicaid.
Then a children's book illustrator talks about painting his way through Michigan.
I had a friend who ran a photo agency, and he also liked to write. So he called me one day. He said, "Nick, you don't have a job for the magazine anymore. How about illustrating a book for me?"
And longtime journalist John Gallagher joins us to talk about entrepreneurship and reinvention in Detroit.
The kind of folks he was working with in Detroit represent that sort of early promise, decline, but then reinvention and recovery, and willing to take a chance on something new.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Later on the program, we'll talk to veteran Detroit journalist John Gallagher about the subject of a new book titled The Englishman and Detroit. It's a story of redemption and innovation from a man and a city.
Well, I think that both in his own life and then the kind of folks he was working with in Detroit represent that sort of early promise, decline, but then reinvention and recovery, and willing to take a chance on something new.
That's later on the show. But first, in just a couple weeks, the remainder of changes made to Michigan's auto insurance law will go into effect. This second wave of changes is of particular concern to those who have been injured in car accidents and receive home care. It's also of concern to care-providing companies that say their businesses will struggle to stay afloat. Here to explain is Chad Livengood, senior editor with Crain's Detroit Business. Chad, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Can you remind us what changed about auto insurance in the state last year and who felt like they came out as victors in this package of changes?
Yeah, so for the first time last July, Michigan motorists were able to opt out of unlimited medical coverage on their auto insurance policy. For the last 40 years, they've been required to carry unlimited personal injury protection, which covers both your hospitalization if you're in a bad car accident, your rehabilitation. It covers lost wages, modifications to your car, to your house. And also, if you are have the unfortunate nature of getting in a really bad accident and you're confined to a wheelchair, it'll cover the cost of home health care aides 24/7 around the clock to be in your house to help care for you. And for the first time, motorists were able to opt out of that coverage if they have health insurance that covers auto accident injuries, or if they have Medicare. And so the whole notion of this was to save people money. Some people are saving money, but not everybody. And that's been kind of part of the rub so far in this 1 year into this reform.
On average, how much is the average car driver saving in their insurance?
You know, it is hard to pin that number down. There have been some studies to show that Michigan has dipped a little to about an statewide average of about $2,500. But in Detroit, where Detroiters have been paying the most expensive premiums in America for years, if not a couple of decades now, one of the most recent surveys by The Zebra, which is a price comparison website, they found in 2019, before the reform, the average Detroiter would have to get charged about $5,500 to insure a 2014 a Honda Accord. This most recent study they did just a couple months ago that the Zebra did, that same car now would insure for $5,000. So a $400 or $500 savings, kind of a sort of a measly 7% in the grand scheme of things. People aren't quite impressed with that kind of savings.
So what happens on July 1st with the changes now that we're almost exactly a year out from those changes being made?
Yeah, so this is a second stage of this new law that was signed by Governor Whitmer after Memorial Day of 2019 that imposes first of its kind cost controls on that medical portion of auto insurance. So it was going to cap hospitals at charging 200% of what Medicare pays them. Medicare may pay them $300 for an MRI, so they'll be able to charge $600. Whereas in the past, they've been able to charge some of the most highest rates, sometimes $3,000 for that MRI that Medicare and the taxpayers paid $300 for, and maybe Blue Cross paid $400 for. So now, then it's going to work its way down the food chain of the hospital system, the rehabilitation centers and therapy centers and physical therapists that you go see if you are in a bad car accident. They're going to get capped if they have a service that's covered by Medicare under what's known as a Medicare billing code. The problem that's arising here is that there's a lot of these services like home health care aides who help take care of you. And it's, you know, they do everything from assisting in food preparation to bathing and helping you get on and off the toilet and such. Those services aren't covered by Medicare. And so the legislature created this rate cap of 55% of what those companies charged on January 1st, 2019. So if they were charging $30 an hour for a home health care nurse or nurse's aide, they'd be capped at 55% of that $30 an hour. The problem is that that's $18 an hour. So the problem is that $18 an hour, the home health care company gets paid, and then they have to pay for an aide in that $18 an hour. And it's very, very hard economics to do that, particularly in this labor market, and particularly in this pandemic labor market, where you have a lot of demand for people to work in the healthcare sector. They can simply command a lot more money. And registered nurses are in huge demand. You can't pay a nurse more less than $40, $45 an hour, and that home healthcare company might charge, usually charge $60. Well, now if they're capped at 55%, you can see where they'll be $33 or so an hour. That's all they've got. Basically, you obviously can't cover the wages of that $40, $45 an hour nurse.
Right.
And so this is sort of the rub. This is taking effect July 1st. These home healthcare companies, rehabilitation centers, brain injury, spinal cord injury centers, they say that these fees are just catastrophic for the catastrophically injured, and they will be essentially out of business.
Chad, if I can just jump in, are there any of these companies that are already planning on shuttering?
Yeah, they're giving people essentially eviction notices. Eisenhower Center on Eisenhower Parkway in Ann Arbor is one. It's really a world-renowned brain injury, spinal cord injury center. They've already sent everybody notice saying, you got to get out June 30th out of our facility. We're shutting the doors of this place. And several other ones, there's a Hope Network is a big provider on the west side of the state. They've already sent notice to some folks who live in one of their facilities in Coldwater. They've got to get out as well, because essentially they just can't stay. They can't keep paying staff. They're going to start laying people off in mass. And we're talking about thousands of jobs that are tied to this industry that's sort of been built up around Michigan's limitless and really robust Cadillac health insurance plans for auto accident victims.
What does this mean for the families and those who have suffered life-altering injuries from car accidents?
Yeah, so they're going to have to find alternative means of care. And some people do get care from family members. So they get care maybe 8 hours a day from that family member. Or maybe it's 12 hours a day from the family member. Then the family member gets someone to relieve them and come in and take cover the other 12 hours a day. Well, this law also caps that family provided attendant care at 56 hours a week, so 8 hours a day. And so because of that, there won't be additional money paid to the family members to take care of their loved ones. And sometimes it's a mom taking care of a son who was injured in a car accident as a teenager, who is now maybe in their 30s or 40s. I mean, folks who get in these bad car accidents, become quadriplegics, they can live for decades. There are people coverage who were injured in the early 80s and still getting care for, paid for by the state catastrophic claims fund. So it's going to really change the dynamics of people, people's lives. People have basically kind of gotten into understanding this. And then there's other folks who just don't have that. I interviewed a woman named Kelly Miller from Eaton County. She's a quadriplegic on a ventilator. She requires a registered nurse and a nurse aide 24/7. Because if that ventilator stops working, the registered nurse has to work to get that ventilator restarted to keep, and then the nurse aide has to use a hand pump bag to pump oxygen into her lungs. The alternative is that people like Kelly will end up having to go to nursing homes and live out their days in nursing homes. And that cost will either be borne by maybe by their car insurance company, but more than likely they're going to end up on Medicaid. And then the taxpayers wound up paying for it.
Chad, what are advocates who are advocating for these victims of these car accidents and their families, what are they hoping to have happen or go forward with a policy? Do they want to see policy change? Do they want to see a reversal? And how likely is that to happen?
They want to see a reversal. They want essentially their rates from 2019 to be frozen. That's their main ask to legislators. But right so far to date, the Republican majority leader in the Senate, Mike Shirkey, and the Republican Speaker of the House, Jason Wentworth, who was one of the authors of this law in the last term, they have been resistant to doing anything and changing anything. Mike Shirkey has repeatedly said he wants to see data on what happens. He wants to sort of let the law play out. The advocates for these injured folks, critically, and we're talking about several thousands of people around the state, they're saying, look, if you do that, the Kelly Millers of the world are going to end up in nursing homes, and you're going to see immediate kind of crisis pressure on nursing homes. There's some question out there whether there's enough certified nursing homes to even handle an influx of thousands of people. And there's some hospitals out there actually preparing for people to just start showing up because they're simply going to need care. And they're not going to be able to get it because these home healthcare companies are going under.
Chad Livengood is a senior editor with Crain's Detroit Business. Chad, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, the artist behind the illustrations from The Legend of Sleeping Bear.
My paintings were very gray, brown, not lit up. But then I started working on the sleeping bear, and I threw all that out the window. This book was the turning point for me to use bright colors.
He's got a new book, and we'll explore his art next. This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Bear. Whether on the shelves of a bookstore, a library, or a cottage up north, you've undoubtedly seen the children's book, The Legend of Sleeping Bear. And you'd recognize the cover art of puffy, black bear-shaped clouds floating over Sleeping Bear Dunes, all of it luminescent orange from a setting Lake Michigan sun. The painter, Heisbert von Frankenhausen, known by friends and acquaintances as Nick, has now illustrated several books for Sleeping Bear Press. His latest work out this year, titled Our Michigan, We Love the Seasons, celebrates all that makes Michigan uniquely beautiful throughout the year. The Dutch native moved to Michigan in the 1970s and effortlessly captures Michigan's splendor from dunes to birch forests, bridges to lighthouses. Nick, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
So in Our Michigan, there's this image of a lighthouse at night overlooking one of the lakes. And I love it because going to lighthouses is one of my favorite things to do in the summer. But what stands out to me about that image is the speckling of the stars, and it's just magnificent. Can you tell me about how you created that effect with your brush?
What I actually did was use an old toothbrush and load it up with paint and then splatter the paint on. Now, this is very tricky because it doesn't always go right, but it's acrylic paint. What I make sure is I make sure the background is completely dry, and I try it after blocking out the areas where I don't want stars. I use little pieces of ripped paper so you don't get a hard line. And then I sprinkle take all the paperback off, look at it and say, yeah, that's okay. And if it's not good, I have a sponge and clean water and I can wash it right back off. As long as the layer under it is dry, I can wash it off. And then I dry it, do it again and build it up. And then in the very end, paint some big ones in certain places. You want to control the big ones with the brush instead of by accident.
I mean, it creates this beautiful effect, the layering of the Milky Way in that image. How do you ensure that something like the toothbrush, which doesn't seem like the most reliable tool in the world, other than for cleaning teeth, how do you ensure that you don't get a big blob or a splatter that is not star-like at all?
Well, you have to make sure that the consistency of the paint is not too thin or too thick. It's a trial and error kind of thing. But that's what I've always used. It's just an old toothbrush, and it works for me. Now, other people might say, oh, I got to use a big house paint brush or a very stiff brush or whatever they want to do. But for me, an old toothbrush works good.
So I think one of the things that would prevent me from being a very good painter is I struggle to recognize when enough is enough. And I probably keep going until I've ruined the image that I liked before. So I wonder how you tell yourself, you know, that's enough. Those stars, that's the perfect amount.
Again, trial and error, I guess. I have ruined paintings. Just like anybody else, going too far. Actually, Robin, my wife, has saved me several times and said, now quit working on it. It's done.
Everybody needs a good partner to tell them that.
Yeah. It's always just what you've done before. Like you learn, the more you do it, the better it's going to be, the more confident you get.
When did you start painting?
Oh, I was 5-6 years old. Actually painting, yes. I drew first, of course, like every kid. And then I got my first watercolors and my first thick paints. And then when I was 12, I got my first oils. And I couldn't work with them, and I put them under the bed and found them again when I was 16. And by then, I could use them and been working on it ever since.
What brought you then to Michigan?
Oh, I was on vacation in Michigan and found out about Michigan Natural Resources magazine. That's the official state publication. Well, this was way back in the 70s, and I had just finished art school in the Netherlands, and I was working. I finished graphic design. And my first job was, of course, at an advertising agency, and I hated it. And I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life. And then I was on vacation in Michigan, saw the magazine. And when I saw that magazine, I knew that that's what I wanted. I wanted to be doing layout, photography, painting, dealing with the printers, doing everything for the magazine. That is what I had learned in art school. And we called the editor and he says, no, there is no job here. We have our own people doing it. And I was really kind of devastated. I wanted that job right there and then, not thinking that somebody already had that job. But on the plane back home, I thought, well, I'm just going to keep bugging the editor by sending him something that I created at the advertising agency. And I'm going to send it every Saturday. I'm going to send him a model over an a sample of my work. And I did that for 11 months. I sent every Saturday, I sent a postcard that I made from something that I created during that week. And I finally got a letter back from him, a postcard, and it said, next time you're in the USA, stop by, we'll talk. I quit my job, was back here in Michigan, walked into the building, got hired about 6 or 7 hours later. So it worked out.
Well, you said that you were on vacation here in Michigan. Were you visiting friends or family?
Friends.
So then you probably were not surprised then by the sizable Dutch population in the state.
Well, I try to kind of stay away from the Dutch population in Michigan.
No!
Yeah, I do. I know a few people in the Dutch population, but there's something about the Dutch people that live here, and that's not bad, but...
You're not saying we're a stoic and joyless people, are you?
No, I was going to say they're all so religious, and I am not so religious, and you know, people leave for different reasons, and it was all the people that got here 100 years ago that were finding their own religion, kind of. I wanted to be away from it. I grew up in a Dutch Reformed family, so it was, I always wanted to get out of that.
Well, Nick, as a Dutch American, I will just not tell you how I feel about that, and we'll move on. Does that sound okay?
That sounds good.
I wanted to talk a little bit about The Legend of Sleeping Bear, which is a wildly popular book. Tell me how you ended up connected with the author and the publishing house to work on The Legend of Sleeping Bear.
Yeah, that was the thing that really changed my whole life around. When I got that offer from Sleeping Bear Press, I had not been working for the magazine since 1993. The magazine died. So I was on my own. I was working, trying to make a living as a painter. And I had a friend who ran a photo agency. And he also liked to write. So he called me one day. He said, Nick, you don't have a job for the magazine anymore. How about illustrating a book for me? I said, sure. That's really what I always wanted to do, is become an illustrator. But it's such a hard place to get into. And he says, well, I've been asked by a company in New York to write a book on firemen stories. And I want you to illustrate that book. Well, if there's one thing hard to paint, it's a fire truck. Especially when you show that painting to a fireman. And it's not something I really want to paint, but I thought if I can get into the publishing business with this book, it's worth a try. So I did 5 paintings, and I gave them to him so he could take them to New York. And he came back and he says, well, they don't want your paintings, and they want you not to paint this, and they want you to paint that. And everything changed, everything. You know, this is just a proposal, and I'm doing it again. And he took him to New York again, and again it got turned down. And that's when I said, you know what, if this is what book publishing is all about, or painting for books, I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. And I gave him the paintings, and he hung them on the wall in his little studio. Heather Hughes from Sleeping Bear Press showed up there a couple days after that, and she saw those paintings hanging on the wall, and she said, where'd you get those paintings? And he said, oh, this guy down the street, he used to work for the magazine, and now he's not anymore. He's just picking up jobs here and there, and he thought he'd illustrate the book, but it didn't work out. And she said, well, give me his name and number. I'm going to call him. Hmm. Sure enough, a day later, Heather called, and she said, I've seen your paintings, and I like them, and would you like to paint the Legend of Sleeping Bear? Well, guess what? Of course. I couldn't believe it. And I did some sketches, some thumbnail sketches to give him an idea. And they rolled right over it, just start painting, and faxed it back to me. Hmm. So I said, okay, here we go. And I started painting. And 2 weeks later, I had all the paintings done. And I called them up. I said, I'm done with the paintings. Shall I come over and drop them off? And they said, sure. So I drove to Chelsea with Robin, and I told her in the car on the way over there, now watch him tell me, we don't want that painted, but we want this painted, and this is wrong, and this is wrong, and this is wrong, and I'm going to probably have to redo all of them. That's how publishing houses work. To make a real long story short, the book that they printed is exactly what I painted, and I even kind of laid it out because I had indicated where all the text should go, and they didn't change a thing.
That's sort of an artist's dream, isn't it?
It is. It really was, and it was totally unexpected.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with children's book illustrator Gijsbert van Frankenhuysen, known by friends and acquaintances as Nick. Nick, there's a painting in The Legend of Sleeping Bear of these great swells of Lake Michigan, whitecaps kind of crashing together to push forward 2 islands, the Manitou Islands.
Uh-huh.
And the earth transforms the baby cubs into permanent land. I hate to spoil the story for everybody. What I had never seen before reading the book again to my daughter last night was these gentle silhouettes of the baby bears along the ridges of the forming islands.
Yeah.
And I'm curious how important it is to you as a painter to communicate subtlety in your art as well as the very clear.
Well, I have to tell you, that was one thing that they actually changed in in that book. I forgot about that. But when I first did the painting, they were definitely bear cubs that were pushed out of the water. And when the publisher saw that, he said, "Oh, no, 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 no. You got to tone that down, Nick. That's too much bear. It's gotta be toned down." So that's, let me look at it real quick. But I know I made it more like trees and dunes instead of black bear cubs. And I do a lot of things in my paintings that people never get, you know, throughout books, or I have a reason why I do something, and that reason gets not seen by other people. And it's fun to hide stuff too.
Yeah. Well, Nick, I'd like to ask you another question about technique, if that's all right.
Sure.
There's this painting of a setting sun in The Legend of Sleeping Bear, and it just glares blindingly off the page. It's something that, as a layman, I've never understood. And I find it in the book of Good Night Moon as well, this ability to use the palette of colors before you to convey bright, shining light. Can you explain to me how you approach that as a painter, conveying light with something as dense as color?
I guess it's just being brave. In the beginning, when I painted, my paintings were gray, not a lot of color. And I think that was my European upbringing and the European weather, especially the Dutch weather. There's not a lot of sun involved. You know, it's raining a lot of times in the Netherlands. But then I started working on the Sleeping Bear, and I threw all that out the window. This book was the turning point for me to use bright colors. And the reason for that was, when I started working on the book, I really didn't know what to do, because this was my serious first children's book. So I went to Schuler's and I watched kids in the book section. Now, that sounds creepy, but it wasn't. I would just sit there and watch a kid look at a book, look at the cover and put it back. Look at another one, grab it out of the rack, look at it, push it back. Grab another one. Oh, sit down and start reading. And I would say, "Why did you put the other two back and you start reading this one?" I asked a lot of kids, and they said, all of them said, the colors, the bright pictures, not much text. That was another thing. If they opened the book and it was all text, oh, put it back down. But if there was more picture than text, they were interested in it.
Right.
And I thought, well, I can do that. And I used color in that book. I didn't even start out with a white canvas. Before I started painting, I would turn my white canvas into almost pure orange.
So you're saying your base color was orange rather than white?
Yeah, oh, yep.
Interesting.
Pure orange. Mm-hmm. And then I painted on top of that. And you can see that color coming through even in the snow painting of the bear laying in the snow. There's still an orange glow in that painting. And in some paintings, it's gone, or mostly gone, because if it doesn't work, I kept working it out. But in that sun painting, that's what I started with, was that pure orange, and then build my whites and yellows on top of that. It is bright, and it works. You have to be gutsy. And I got there with this book.
So when we see that glow coming off of each of the bears that surrounds each of them, is that from the base color?
Yeah. If it's orange or brownish looking, that is always the background color. Yeah, for the very sad mother bear that finally is on the shore, you can see it around her ears and in the bottom and on her back. It's leaving that little bit of color from the background, and it really works.
Now that we're in a digital age, I know that there's this beautiful art that can be created, especially for children's books on computers or tablets, even. By illustrators, but clearly you're still committed to painting, and you can see the dappling of canvas pushing through with each of your illustrations. Yeah. Tell me why you're committed to painting still when there are so many digital tools and mediums available to you now.
No, I hate all this computer stuff myself. I cannot do it. I can email, and that's where it stops. I don't know how to do anything on the computer. I I can download my pictures. I take lots of photographs too. I love to sit in the blind and get animal pictures. I can spend the whole day in the blind and come home with 500 pictures and put them on the screen and sort them out. And I can do that, but I cannot manipulate anything. And if I want to make a painting, sometimes people see my photo and they say, "Oh, are you going to make that a painting?" I said, "No, this is kind of separate. I do the photography and I do painting, but I can get an idea from a painting, a certain light or a certain color or a certain something. And I use that in my paintings." I like the process of taking paint, the basic colors, and coming up with any color that you like and creating it into a painting that I want, you know, the way I want it, with a brush and doing it. That's it's fun. It's exciting.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for joining us today and talking to us a little bit about your work. It's been a delight.
Well, it was fun. Thank you very much.
Gijsbert van Frankenhuysen is a children's book illustrator, including The Legend of Sleeping Bear and a new work titled Our Michigan. Up next, journalist John Gallagher has the story of entrepreneurship and reinvention in the city of Detroit.
I think Randall's the kind of guy that just sees opportunity. And he's also, he's just a delightful person. I mean, he really is wonderful working with people. He knows how to be an effective leader. And I think that's really an important part of his success.
Stay with us.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. I want you to imagine standing on stage in front of an audience. You're singing and you're vibing and you're playing that keyboard like you have done so many times before, and the crowd is really feeling it too. But what nobody knows is that while you're playing, you're also conducting your own therapy exercise with every stroke of your fingers, left to right, you're working through anxieties. Performer Jess Kramer practices something called eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, or EMDR. It's a tool that people use to process anxiety, and it involves tapping the left and right hands to stimulate the left and right parts of our brains. So when a pandemic forces us to totally reimagine so many things, home space, our creative inspirations, our work, onstage therapy sometimes has to go through some changes too. Jess Kramer joins us now to talk more about her creative life and how it's changed since the pandemic. Jess, welcome to Stateside.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
When did you start performing?
I have been performing original music live since I was a senior in high school. So that was 2005. And I have not stopped ever since for more than a few months at a time. So it's been a really consistent thing in my adulthood.
It's been a consistent practice, but has music and performing music for others, has that been for consistent reasons over time? Have you felt in a consistent way about it?
I have. You know, for the most part, I was surprised by how much that connection gave back to me when I started doing it when I was, you know, 17 years old. And I think I almost became addicted to it, right? Of this idea of presenting something so personal in a sharing space with others and getting immediate feedback and seeing if they're reacting. And so for me, it was a way of, yeah, connecting to the people who I may or may not have known with personal stories and sort of, you know, finding that common human ground.
So then I'm guessing this is a parallel track, but not necessarily that runs in the same direction. How did you realize that you were dealing with anxiety?
I mean, that's the funny thing about performing is that anxiety is expected, right? So the like stage fright and finding ways to just push through it, it's part of the process. And it's like a very rewarding part of the process that I wasn't thinking about it in any personal terms. It was just like, okay, I'm about to get on stage in front of 20 or 400 people. This is a normal feeling. But then to realize that it goes a lot deeper than that. And I think that would mostly come up when I was maybe performing something for the first time or something I had just finished writing or maybe hadn't even totally finished writing yet. And I was trying it out in front of a crowd, but that anxiety feeling of like, I'm presenting a whole new idea that I don't know how they're going to react was really when I started to tune into how I personally interacted with this part of creative performance.
I wonder if you could tell us in your own words what eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, what it means.
Yeah, so it's a relatively new therapy for me. I had tried it briefly many years ago and just now revisited it maybe 6 months ago. And the most simplified way that I like to talk about it is it's a way to hold trauma and triggers and train your brain to use physical movements in some way, whether it be eye movement, which is sort of the historical origins of it, or I like to do tapping. Some people will use auditory left and right and have sounds play in headphones, but sort of trick the brain in a way to calm itself down when you're faced with triggers and trauma, and sort of creating these links and tools so that when you go outside of a therapy session and you're faced with something that causes anxiety, you can remember, okay, left and right, sort of rhythmic, and calm yourself down to a place where you can approach it with more logic than trigger.
Well, how does the practice work of it? What is the movement that you do to stimulate the left and then the right side of your brain?
Yeah, so I find that I do better accessing the emotional space you have to come from if my eyes are closed. So the light therapy doesn't work very well for me. So I like to keep my eyes closed, and I literally just sit in a chair, and I have my left and right palms on my knees, and I just very slowly tap left and right in a rhythm. And that way, as we're talking through very difficult things, it sort of feels like walking or like marching, to have this stimulation on your left and right legs.
Right. So these are the motions that you're doing on the keyboard while you're performing, right?
Yeah, very, very much similar. It's maybe a little less rhythmic with my hands when I do keyboard, but when I perform, I'm usually playing a couple of keyboards at like chest level. And then I've also started using a lot of foot pedals, either for like keyboard bass, or I utilize a loop pedal when I'm performing live. So there's actually left and right with hands and feet happening on stage when I play live.
Now, folks in the know who read People magazine may have heard that Prince Harry practices EMDR every time he flies into London. It is gaining a much wider audience as it's becoming a bit more of a topic in therapy and in mental health. But when you first started doing it, had you ever heard of anybody else who was doing this?
I had. I was really lucky to have a small group of friends who are very transparent about what therapies work for them. And so I had had a couple of conversations with trusted folks about how it had helped them calm down these triggers. And so when I was looking for therapists most recently to find a new one during pandemic, I actually did a search based on who was qualified to do EMDR therapy.
Was it very hard to find someone?
There was a pretty decent selection. It was hardest to find people who practiced EMDR and had open availability, because it seems like a lot of people got very busy during the pandemic in therapy offices. So,
oh yeah,
I was able to find I think three people that I reached out to and then narrowed down to my therapist. Yeah,
being on stage is already kind of a balancing act. You're playing and you're singing. Many performers kind of read the audience, like you mentioned, and try to gauge their reaction, maybe even interact a little bit. Hopefully also you're getting into your own groove while you're up there. Was it difficult to develop this skill and to think about moving your hands in that way in addition to everything else that was going on?
You know, I think the movement came really naturally for me. And the link here is it's very normal for me to sort of have to do a consistent physical movement whether I'm accessing trauma moments in therapy or whether I'm singing about something really difficult that I went through. I'm used to holding like sort of a mathematical consistency with my movements while I access big emotions. What was different for me that I actually found kind of jarring was when you're doing it in front of an audience, there's this expectation that you're kind of holding it together, mm-hmm. right? That you're like, you are staying on stage, you are staying composed enough to be singing, because singing is hard to do if you're crying. And that was a really big shift for me in therapy, is like, there's no one watching this. I think that was such a moment of creative shift for me, is like, what is the value for me in accessing these vulnerable moments with no one watching, or maybe one person watching, you know, with a therapist. But there's a different sort of expectation of holding it together that felt really different, even if the movements and the feelings were really similar.
Yeah. Jess, can you describe what the effect feels like when EMDR is practiced properly, when you're on stage and you're doing this? I mean, how does it feel?
Well, I think there is a difference. There's a difference between EMDR-like performance and the feeling that comes after, because you're literally met with applause, right? There's a sort of high when you do it successfully. But for me, in an EMDR session, it feels very much like you've peeled back a lot of layers and you're very raw. And so I think I'm still accessing a similar part of myself, and maybe that's the difference between doing it in front of an audience and doing it privately, right? Is that there's an expectation of sort of like a triumphant applause at the end of one, and at the other, you're like in your house closing your laptop.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Jess Kramer. She's a musician who lives in Grand Rapids. And like so many other Michigan musicians, she's had to put the pause on performing this year. Unlike a lot of other musicians, though, this has also meant a pause on a form of therapy that she practices on stage. Jess, I know you have an 11-year-old son, and parents the world over have been making do with the wild lifestyle changes that everybody's been dealing with during COVID. Can you talk a little bit about what it's been like for your family?
Yeah, you know, in a lot of ways, we were really, really lucky. Last March, when the schools shut down, and suddenly we were trying to figure out working from home and not sending my son off to school. We were very lucky. I co-parent with two other households. So my son, I guess the easiest way is sort of a relay race. I'm a single parent that splits time three ways. And he was able to stay home with someone at every household so he could maintain his same schedule. But for all of us, it was like, okay, well, when he's in school, we're also working, we're juggling, checking in on him, making sure that we can keep our work going. And it was suddenly just everything was based in the same space, you know, making music, me working my day job, his schooling was all in the same home. And we didn't get breaks from each other in the same way that we were used to, which, I mean, I really loved personally. I love being home with my son and can be sort of a homebody in that way, but it does affect your natural rhythm that you've gotten used to with social life and even just, you know, had to update my internet speed because suddenly we have all of these devices. Our education and our work are relying on being able to simultaneously do all of these things from home.
Yeah. We frequently talk to people who say they've had trouble just finishing reading a book during the pandemic. Did you have much of a creative process over the past year or so?
You know, it's interesting. I've really struggled to create anything new. What I have been able to do pretty well is revisit old things that weren't finished, sort of like reusing leftovers. So I've been working on a lot of unfinished songs from years back, and I haven't honestly written anything that I would consider a full song, but suddenly had this energy to sort of go back and revisit old things. That was strange. I released a new song about a year ago, June of 2020. But, I had been writing it for a while. I had started writing it pre-pandemic and was just able to finish and release it while everything was locked down.
Is that the song that you put out to celebrate Pride last year?
Yeah, I did. It was sort of a coincidental release. It was a love song that I wrote, so it was a gay love song, and thought that June was an apt time to put it out into the world. But that was also just when I felt like it was ready to share.
Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about the writing it and, I guess, the finishing of it?
Yeah, I started writing that song probably 2 years before it actually came out. And I had performed it live a couple of times, tried out a couple of different versions. And it always felt really incomplete. And I think part of that is that the song is written about someone that I dated that it sort of left off without any closure. And I was really grappling with like how you can hold love and affection and admiration for someone and just not be able to explain why it didn't work. And so I think it was a struggle because a lot of times I use songwriting to write an ending to a feeling or to something that I went through, right? Sort of this zoom out of being able to make sense of something that I went through. And with this one, I couldn't find the part where it made sense. And so I was mirroring that very much in the songwriting process and then the production of it, and I couldn't find a way to end the song in a way that felt right. And it finally, I tried all of these things to add some closure to it and ended up with the fact that there wouldn't be closure. And that sometimes that's the most honest way to talk about a thing, is just to be like, I don't know what happened. Here's a song about it. So I decided just to finish it as it was, to finish the production and put it out into the world and to sort of let it be a loose end as a song.
The finished product is called Shake It. Let's take a listen.
Your presence is a blanket, and I have not been able to shake it, been able to shake.
Jess, you just told us that you haven't really composed anything new in the past year. You've mostly just been working on things that you had already started writing, sometimes maybe years ago. But is there anything else creative that you're doing that's sort of been getting you through this time?
You know, it's funny. I think that creative energy's gotten sucked up so much. A lot of where my brain has gone is sort of the mathematical side of it, which my music is still pretty mathematical. When you're building things with a loop pedal, you know, it's very much in patterns and order and timing. But I feel like so much of my creative energy has just had to go to everyday things, what a creative reimagining of what work looks like, and a creative reimagining of what parenting looks like, and reimagining what friendships look like when you can't be in the same place. And so no, that creative generation has really just, it's been on pause in a musical sense. You know, there have been little ways that I've been able to do like live stream concerts for fans and perform. And I've, you know, recorded a couple of covers of other people's songs, some of which I did collaboratively and some of which I did solo. So it's been important for me to still make music, but to actually create new content, it feels like that well's been really dry. And it's been a real practice in patience to just sit with that as like the current reality as a musician. Just to know that it's not there right now. So how else can I keep at least, you know, picking up my instruments and finding joy in a creative process that looks a little bit different?
Mm-hmm. We're coming up on the date when Michigan is going to reopen capacity at venues. And there are starting to be rumblings about small gatherings and even shows. I know we spent the first part of this interview talking about this intimate and personal experience that you have during performance. Now I'm wondering, are you feeling like you might be ready to get back up on a stage?
I was actually really comforted by the idea of smaller capacity shows, because I love that connection with a smaller room of people. And I love the idea of coming back from not having live shows for so long and sort of sharing that appreciation for that moment. I currently have decided only to perform outdoor shows. And the reason for that is my son is 11 and he's still not eligible for the vaccine. So as far as risk management, I feel like outdoor is a space that I feel safe and I'm really excited to connect by doing some outdoor performances. But, you know, down the road, if he is eligible for a vaccination, I think I'm ready to go back to an indoor venue. I think it's going to be really, it's going to be kind of terrifying to go back into that space that was so comforting for so long and to be like, oh, right, this is relearning how to perform in front of a crowd and how, you know, to show up as a person that's just been through a year and a half of processing all of these things alone and like dipping back into sharing it with a room of people. I'm really not sure how it's going to feel, but I hope I can get back to it in the next couple of months.
You figure out what it means all over again.
I think so, and I think that's the beauty of it, to come back as somebody slightly different.
Well, for now, we'll just say Jess Kramer's music can be found and experienced on Spotify and also on Bandcamp. And if you're looking for information on EMDR,
there's information about that available online as well. Jess, it's been really nice talking to you. Thank you for sharing your story with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time.